and then make a beeline back to safety in Israel. These unfortunate travelers miss a lot and come home with only one narrative. This means that pilgrims who visit the Holy Land to walk where Jesus walked seldom walk with the people Jesus walked with. They rarely interact with Palestinian Christians. The fact that not all Palestinians are Muslims surprises some. When meeting an Arab Christian, many tourists ask when their family was converted. The answer is usually, oh, about 2,000 years ago, back when Jesus' disciples were doing missionary work around here. A century ago, about 20% of Palestinians were Christian. But many Arab Christians fled the draft during World War I. Since the ruling Ottomans were neither Arab nor Christian, these Arab Christians saw no reason to fight in their army. And many more have fled with the rising sectarian tensions of recent decades. Today, Christians make a tiny sliver of the Palestinian population, and most of them live here in Bethlehem. With the rise of Islamists across the region making parishioners nervous, the church needs people to stay. Christian leaders meet monthly with Muslim imams to discuss growing extremism in the Muslim community and a growing uneasiness among Christians. The village of Beit Zahur, just a 30-minute walk east of Bethlehem, is the site of the famous Shepherd's Fields. In these fertile fields, the Bible tells of an angel who said to ancient shepherds, "Do not be afraid, for see, I am bringing you good news of great joy for all the people. To you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, who is the Messiah, the Lord. This will be a sign for you. You will find a child wrapped in bands of cloth and laying in a manger." Today, pilgrims still come to these fields to hear the good news and then spread it throughout the world. Locals say that God knew what he was doing because this town is still notorious in Palestine for its gossiping. Even news less important than the coming of the Messiah spreads fast from Beit Zahur. That evening, back at my Bethlehem hotel, I bumped into a dozen Lutheran pastors in the lobby. They were heading into the 2,000-year-old cave upon which the hotel was built for devotional service. They invited me along. Although I was really tired, I followed my travel ethic. If an opportunity presents itself, say yes. I climbed down into the cave with them and enjoyed a wonderful hour of singing, reading, and sharing. It was simply beautiful. You meet far fewer tourists in the West Bank than elsewhere, but those you do meet are really interesting. Walls and settlements. It's about land. Like Holy Land Monopoly. As long as I've been politically active, since my first trip to Central America back in the Contra Sandinista days, I've been impressed by how land issues are so fundamental to peace with justice. And land, it seems to me, is what the struggles in the Holy Land are all about. Two hot-button land issues dominate much of the debate. Israel's erection of a barrier around the West Bank and the Israeli construction of settlements within West Bank territory. In an effort to get a balanced as possible take, I made a point to talk with people on both sides, physically and philosophically, of this divide. Begun in 2003, a 300-mile-long fortified barrier now separates Israel from the West Bank. What Israelis call the security fence, or anti-terrorism barrier, Palestinians, who consider it an affront to their dignity, call the separation wall, or the apartheid wall, or simply the wall. Israelis explain that the barrier is essential to their national security and needed to be built after losing hundreds of its citizens to suicide bombers in the previous decade. And they claim it's been effective, noting that since its construction, there's been far less violence. Palestinians would counter by saying that the wall was built only with the pretense of security. Several locals assured me that if anyone really wants to get through the wall, which is far from finished, it's very easy to do. They don't credit the wall for the decline in violence, but say it's because the West Bank, its leaders, its security forces, and most of its people have all realized that violence is a losing strategy. Palestinians also view the wall as a land grab designed to hobble a Palestinian state. The wall generally runs well within Palestinian territory. It's nearly twice as long as the border it claims to defend, gerrymandered in order to secure Israeli settlements, aquifers, good farmland, and religious and archaeological sites within the West Bank. While it can look landscaped and attractive from the Israeli side, the wall is gloomy and oppressive from the Palestinian side. Walking through the border checkpoint is enlightening and, for some people, uncomfortable. For a Western tourist, it's easy. Leaving Jerusalem, I took a cab to the checkpoint, flashed my ID, walked through the turnstile, and hopped into one of the many taxis waiting on the Palestinian side for the quick ride into downtown Bethlehem. Most of the traffic passing through the border checkpoint is not tourists, but Palestinians heading to and from work in Jerusalem. Like border towns between rich and poor lands all over the world, workers with special passes cross the border every day on their commute for higher-paying jobs in the more affluent country. I can understand Israel's need for security, but my hunch is that the wall is designed at least partly to separate people from people. At least it functions that way, and to me, that's part of the problem. I sensed that the younger generation on both sides wanted to get beyond the baggage of their parents and connect. But with this barrier, there's literally no common ground where people from opposite sides can come together. Walls are ugly. They may be necessary at times, but they represent a diplomatic failure. In addition to the wall, Israel has steadily encroached upon Palestinian territory by building hilltop settlements in the West Bank. Today, more than 500,000 Israeli Jews live in settlements in Palestinian land. These are planned communities, beautifully landscaped and designed, offering the same modern conveniences and efficiency that you'd expect in a gated community in the United States. And thanks to Israeli government subsidies for housing and transportation, young Jewish families can afford to live here and comfortably commute to jobs back in Israel. For many, choosing to live in a settlement is simple economics, a deal too good to refuse. When Palestinians complain about Israelis building homes here, they hear many justifications. Supporters of these settlements make the case that developing this land is reasonable because it was unused. Israelis also explain that settlement construction creates a needed buffer zone, an action they can defend by simply pointing to their recent history. They also say that according to international law, if land is used to attack a nation, that nation has the legal right to both occupy and settle that land for its own defense. And many Jews and evangelical Christians who are inclined to support them believe it's God's will that they occupy this land. A certain breed of Christian believes that, according to the Bible, Judgment Day will only happen when Jews control the entire Holy Land. And they support Israel simply because they'd like to move things along. To better understand the settlers' perspective, I spent some time in a few Israeli settlements that were built during the last decade or so in the West Bank. Strolling along Leave It to Beaver streets under the red-tiled roofs of cookie-cutter homes, I felt as if I were in suburban America. Gangs of happy-go-lucky children on their bikes were eager to befriend me, and there was a relaxed vibe. I spoke to one couple who's raising 10 children in one of Israel's biggest and most modern settlements. Chatting in a cafe at their mall, they acknowledged that the rest of the world may not like it, referring to the rest of the world as just another opinion. Describing their community as a city rather than a settlement, they were thankful to have a place to raise their children according to their values in a secure and affordable environment. I also enjoyed a beer and a chat with a resident of a simple and rustic settlement in the Jordan River Valley. He said he was not there as a Zionist, but because it was quiet and offered his young family a back-to-nature home with wonderful neighbors. He told me, "You never see the stars in Tel Aviv like we do here." In another settlement, I met a 24-year-old man who had just bought his home and was thrilled to invite me in. He and his buddy talked with me on their balcony overlooking a vast and unpopulated view. They said that the land was going unused anyway, so why shouldn't industrious Israeli Jews develop it? They can pump in water from desalinization plants and build a slick freeway to provide a fine place for people to live within a short drive of good jobs back in Israel proper. When I asked these young men if there's any hope for a good and peaceful future in this region, I was struck by how matter-of-factly they said, "Only if the Palestinians move east across the Jordan River and into the country of Jordan." Walking through an Israeli settlement, I can see the appeal of these neighborhoods. But history has taught us that when a government plants its citizens in disputed territory, the descendants of those original settlers are likely to pay a steep price. Ultimately, rather than cheap, that land is very costly. I've also learned that these Israeli enclaves embitter the Palestinians as much as violent resistance and terrorism embitters Israelis. And the more settlements are built, the more the West Bank becomes fragmented, and the more difficult a mutually agreeable two-state solution, or any solution for that matter, may become. While I hope it's not true, I worry that the aggressive establishment of these settlements today could haunt Israel's prospects for a peaceful resolution to the tensions in the Middle East tomorrow. I see three possible outcomes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The first scenario is two independent and secure states, Jewish Israel and Palestine. The second scenario is one modern, pluralistic, and democratic secular state with a dominant Jewish population and an equal and protected Palestinian minority. Unfortunately, this is untenable for anyone who believes in a Jewish state, as over time, according to demographic trends, the Muslim minority would grow to outnumber the current Jewish majority, tipping the balance of power. The third and last option is one Jewish state with its Palestinian minority kept on the equivalent of Indian reservations, what some would call an apartheid state. I don't believe an apartheid state is what Israel wants, and I don't believe it's the best option for Israel. But as Israel continues to build settlements that carve up the West Bank, I fear the country may be forcing itself into an ugly and undesirable corner. With a two-state scenario becoming less and less likely, Israel will have to be one state. And if that state is to remain Jewish, Israel may ultimately have no option but to become what most Israelis don't want it to be, in order to simply be. The beauty of Palestine, olives, Bedouins, and salty seas. After just a couple of days in Palestine, I was really impressed by how much fun it was to simply be there. I sensed a resilience, a welcoming spirit, and a warmth that was striking. While I rarely saw fellow Americans, everywhere I went I heard over and over, "Welcome to Palestine." It's as if people were just thrilled that they have a name for their country, and someone from the outside world was there to see their flags flapping in the West Bank breeze. Driving through the Palestinian countryside, the vistas feel timeless. I couldn't help but imagine Abraham, Jesus, or Muhammad traversing these same valleys. One place in the West Bank that stole my heart was a natural preserve for hiking near the village of Batir, west of Bethlehem. A fine trail snaked along the same terraces that defined this terrain in ancient times. These 3,000-year-old terraces, known as the Biblical Terraces, were lined with stately and graceful olive trees. Here in the Holy Land, the land itself is holy to its inhabitants. For Palestinians, the olive tree, a symbol of steadfastness and faith in the future, is a kind of lifeblood for the culture. Known as the Tree of Poor People, it gives without taking. As they like to say, "It was planted by our grandfathers for us to eat, and we plant it for our grandchildren to eat." Each autumn, across the land, as they have since ancient times, families gather in the olive groves for the harvest. Children are let out of school for the week so they can work the trees with their parents. Then families take their olives to the communal village press to make oil. Stumbling upon one of these village presses in action is a treat. The traditional technique survives, though boosted by hard-working machinery, as a busy crew in oil-soaked shirts meets the demand of the harvest season. Rounds of olive paste are pressed into a weeping mass of fresh oil, which, after filtering, becomes a golden liquid poured into jugs to be taken home. Another unforgettable dimension of Palestine was its Bedouins. Scattered through the Palestinian countryside, like timeless limpets, are the settlements of nomadic Bedouin tribes, filling dusty gullies with their scrappy shacks and goat corrals. Children and sheepdogs follow their flocks of goat and sheep as they search for something to munch on. While hardscrabble communities still eke out an off-the-grid existence, their way of life is dying. Like nomads everywhere, Bedouins are being driven into a world where people have addresses and send their children to school to learn the prevailing values of that society. With the political tensions between Israel and Palestine, the walls, settlements, freeway construction, and aggressive water politics, I was told that Bedouin camps are now less mobile and stick to land near roads where they can tap into water mains. After so many centuries, more and more Bedouin families are finally settling down in towns and villages. As their ability to roam free is disappearing and their access to water is becoming more limited, they are, by necessity, adapting. And yet these Bedouins are trying to maintain their traditions as much as a nomad with a roof over his head can. Visiting a Bedouin settlement and watching the man of the house roast coffee with a reverence for tradition is mesmerizing. Observing him at work, it struck me that the dignity of these people and their closeness to the land is emblematic of Palestinians in general. And tasting his fresh-brewed coffee, it was like sealing a new friendship. Also hiding in the folds of the desert are fabled monasteries, which, since ancient times, have given hermit monks the isolation of their dreams. The dramatically set Monastery of St. George, built on cliffs above a natural spring, welcomes pilgrims and tourists alike. For 15 centuries, the faithful have ventured to this remote spot, hiked into the ravine, quenched their thirst, and nourished their souls. Orthodox Christians, whether from Palestine, Greece, Russia, or Ethiopia, enliven these monasteries today as they have since the 6th century. I ascended the dramatic Wadi Kilt viewpoint for a thrilling panorama over the Judean desert. Then my ears popped as I dropped below sea level and passed through the ancient city of Jericho. Dating back some 10,000 years, it's one of the oldest continuously inhabited cities on Earth. Locals claim that the thick air that comes with this low altitude, nearly 1,000 feet below sea level, makes their bananas, oranges, and dates particularly tasty. The road ends where the Jordan River does, at the lowest place on Earth, about 1,400 feet below sea level, the fabled Dead Sea. The Jordan continuously empties into this inland sea. Because there's no outlet for the water, and the scalding sun, almost unbearable in the summer, causes constant evaporation, the minerals concentrate. That's why the water is more than one-third minerals, mostly bromine, magnesium, and iodine, and people taking a dip find themselves extremely buoyant. Tourists are more than welcome here, and they enjoy bobbing like corks in water that's about 6 times as salty as the ocean. A dip rubs salt on cuts you didn't know you had. Keep the water out of your eyes, and float near a shower. Dead Sea spas have an impressive brag list. The soothing air is thick, there's 10% more oxygen here than at sea level, and hazy with bromine, a natural tranquilizer. Visitors rub the Dead Sea's magically curative black mud all over their bodies. Many believe the mud's minerals make their skin younger and more beautiful. Palestinians living in the West Bank have access to no waterfront. Israel even adjusted the border to control the entire Dead Sea shoreline. But when tensions are low, Palestinian families who can afford the admission are allowed to enjoy some Israeli Dead Sea resorts. You can identify Arab houses by their black water tanks. Traveling through the West Bank, you become attuned to telltale symbols of a divided society. For example, the skylines of Palestinian cities and towns are dotted with these black water tanks. Tanks are black to better absorb the heat of the sun and warm the water. While Israeli settlers have running water whenever they like, Israel controls and limits water service to Palestinian-held areas. These rooftop water tanks give Palestinians a private reservoir when Israel shuts the water off. Each community has its concerns. They say the first thing an Israeli considers when building a house is a bomb-hardened safe room. And the first thing a Palestinian considers is building a cistern to collect water. Along with water tanks and solar panels, Palestinian rooftops also sport satellite dishes to connect to Arab and international satellites, which serve as their window on the world. Palestinians told me that many here keep the TV on at all times. To them, breaking news stories aren't just entertainment, but critical updates about their constantly shifting political reality. Driving through the West Bank at night was also instructive. In the countryside, there were no streetlights unless I was under an Israeli settlement or military base, in which case the highway was well lit, including powerful spotlights facing away from the road, illuminating the land nearby. In the distance, the faint flicker of open fires, lanterns, and makeshift dangle lighting marked off-the-grid Bedouin camps, and I could identify Palestinian towns on the horizon by the proud green lights festooning their minarets. Palestinian borders, complex as ABC. As a visitor zipping from Palestinian city to city on fine modern freeways, it's easy to underestimate the complexity of the region and the extent of Israeli control. Palestinians living in the West Bank, while nominally autonomous, feel they're under Israeli occupation. Palestinian cities are generally Palestinian-run with their own security forces. But these islands of relative independence are surrounded by land and roads controlled by Israeli military. Since the 1993 Oslo Peace Accords, the West Bank has been subdivided into pockets of land classified into three zones, areas A, B, and C. It's kind of wonky, but interesting. Let me explain. Area A, 18% of the land in the West Bank with about 55% of the people, is made up of urban islands within the West Bank. It contains most of the Palestinian cities and towns and is entirely controlled by the Palestinian Authority. Area B is filled mostly with infrastructure connecting the islands of autonomy that combine to make Area A. While Area B is technically under Palestinian civil authority, it's effectively controlled by the Israeli military. Palestinian license plates are green and Israeli plates are yellow. When times are good, all cars are allowed. In troubled times, traffic is yellow plates only. If there's unrest or a problem, Israel can shut down Area B border crossings all over the country and stop all traffic in the West Bank. In minutes, they can isolate and lock down every Palestinian city. Area C, holding most of the West Bank's uninhabited land, is under complete Israeli authority. While Area C is nominally a part of Palestine, there can be no Palestinian building in Area C without Israeli permission, which is rarely granted. Area C also includes modern Israeli highways that cut through the West Bank, connecting Jewish settlements in Palestine with Israel proper. Checkpoints stand sternly at the boundary between Israeli-controlled land and Palestinian territory. Some are manned, others are empty in a simple drive-through, and flying checkpoints can pop up unexpectedly in the middle of nowhere. But all checkpoints come with a watchtower reminding everyone that Israel is keeping an eye on things. For Palestinians, the needless wasted time spent sitting at these checkpoints is aggravating and humiliating. Driving by one, I saw two soldiers checking papers one car at a time, holding up traffic in the opposite direction and creating a huge traffic jam in the baking sun. Although Palestinians still feel that they live at least partly under Israeli occupation, they try to remember what an historic accomplishment it is that the land in Area A is free and self-ruled, and it has been since 1993, for the first time after centuries of foreign control. A synagogue, a mosque, and bulletproof glass. Jews and Muslims sharing Abraham in Hebron. Hebron is the West Bank's biggest city with 700,000 people, and it's also home to one of the holiest sites in the Holy Land. The Tomb of Abraham, revered by Jews, Muslims, and Christians. According to Scripture, Abraham had one son by his wife, Sarah, that was Isaac, the ancestor of the Israelis, and he had another son by their Egyptian servant, Hagar, and that was Ishmael, for whom the Arabs are descended. That's why both Jews and Muslims come to the Tomb of Abraham to be close to their great patriarch. While sharing this common patriarch could have been an opportunity for unity and cooperation, instead, it's turned the tomb into a divisive place with an uneasy aura. The Tomb of Abraham stands right in the center of town, where Israeli troops are posted in the name of security. In the surrounding streets, Jews live literally atop Muslims as the two communities struggle to be near the shrine of their common patriarch. While the city is mostly Palestinian, a determined and well-protected community of several hundred Israeli settlers has staked out the high ground. The tension between the communities is illustrated by a wire net that protects the Arab food and clothing market from the garbage tossed down by the Jewish residents who live above. Observing this, I wondered what Abraham would think about the inability of his feuding descendants to live together. And it's all about one complicated and tragic site, the Tomb of the Patriarchs, an ancient structure capped by what was a medieval church, which now functions both as a mosque and a synagogue, holding the tombs of Abraham and his family. Abraham purchased this burial plot almost 4,000 years ago, as explained in Genesis chapter 23. For centuries, Jews were generally not allowed to worship here. Then, after the Israeli victory in 1967's Six-Day War, this holy site was shared by Muslims and Jews. But during a Muslim service in 1994, a Jewish settler entered with his gun and killed 29 Palestinian worshippers. Since then, this holy space has been smothered with security and divided, half mosque and half synagogue, with Abraham's tomb in the middle, granting both communities partial access. Sadly, this shrine comes with bulletproof glass and barred windows so that his two sons' feuding descendants can respect his grave. On one side of the glass, Jews worship in the synagogue, enlivened with singing, studying, and praying among the tombs of their great patriarchs. And the other half is a mosque where Muslims worship with equal fervor. Hebron is the place where I feel the most tension in the West Bank. Jews expect access, as do Muslims, and with a history of massacres on both sides, any trust is fragile. Palestinians can do little but annoy the huge number of Israeli soldiers stationed there, and vice versa. During my visit, I noticed that they were putting down protective mats over the venerable carpets in the mosque. When I asked why, I was told that they expected an inspection by the Israeli soldiers, and they never knew if the soldiers would remove their boots before entering. I sensed a sad and unsettling sentiment of occupiers' vengeance among these young Israeli soldiers who seemed to have little empathy for the people they were controlling. I remembered learning how in World War I the French and Germans were so willing to slaughter each other on the Western Front because the vast majority of them had never broken bread with someone from the other side. The society here seems intentionally structured to prevent people from both communities from knowing each other. These seemingly likable young soldiers were fun to chat with. Then, when it was time to go, one of them said, "Time to go bust down a door." His friends in uniform laughed, and they were off. A stroll through Balata refugee camp. Refugees are a big issue in the Holy Land. When Jews returned to their ancestral homeland after World War II to create the modern state of Israel, they displaced hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. Many of these families still live in refugee camps in the West Bank. The biggest, with over 20,000 people, is Balata, just outside the city of Nablus. The original 10-foot by 10-foot platting, marking where tents were pitched in 1948, survives. Only now the tents are gone, replaced by multi-story cinder block tenements. Exploring these narrow lanes, I tried to imagine living in such tight quarters, being a parent with children and little money, the feeling of desperation and no way out. The density is horrible, and there's little privacy. It's a land of silent orgasms. Walking through the Balata camp, I made a point to remember that throughout the world there are refugee camps filled with people living this way. When we travel, we draw a tiny line of experience across our globe. But what we experience hints at a much broader reality. Although we see very little, we can learn a lot. From one country to the next, a gated community is a gated community. A happy person with clean running water is a happy person. And a refugee camp, regardless of who lives there and why, is filled with destitution, frustration, and faint but persistent hope. Wandering the streets of Balata offered a vivid glimpse of life here. Mothers send their sons out for chicken, and they bring home a very fresh bird ready to cook. The boy selects a bird from the cage. The butcher slits its throat, drains it, and tosses the bird into a spinner to remove all the feathers. Then he guts it, washes it, puts it in a plastic bag, and collects a few coins. Palestinians call the spinner a ma'alta. That's the same word they use for the turnstile they have to go through at security checkpoints. At an internet cafe in the refugee camp, I saw kids spending a few pennies playing violent shoot-em-up games. One little boy turned to me and said, "Shalom." Another boy, just as cute, looked at me and said, F you, rich man. Part of me was impressed. Balada's political art, typical of the graffiti decorating the wall separating Israel and Palestine, comes with powerful symbolism. And for Palestinian refugees, one of the most poignant symbols is a key. In 1948, when the families now living in Balata left their homes, they were told it would be for a short time. They locked up and took their keys. Now, more than 60 years later, many of these people, or their children, still treasure those old keys and are eager to tell their story. In Balada and throughout the West Bank, I saw Palestinian kids with toy guns shooting imaginary Jews. It was disturbing to me. But then, in the Israeli settlements, I saw Jewish kids with plastic guns gunning down imaginary terrorists. And it occurred to me, if we're being honest, what American man didn't grow up with a toy gun happily shooting Indians or Soviets in their imagination? Whether it's cowboys and Indians, commies and capitalists, or Jews and Arabs, little boys throughout the world are raised with a toy gun in their hands to shoot their parents' bad guys. But many parents take the opposite tack. I asked a Palestinian whether children here are taught in schools to hate Jews, as some Israelis allege. He said, "As a parent raising my family under this Jewish occupation, it's my challenge to teach our children not to hate Jews." The conditions in Balata are dismaying, particularly when you think that people have been living this way here for decades. But Israelis point out that they've taken in many Jewish refugees and assimilated them into their prosperous society. Meanwhile, they claim that Palestine and the Arab world has intentionally kept the West Bank refugee camps in squalor in order to stir public opinion against Israel. Observing the Holy Land from a distance through a media lens, we can't really get an honest picture of the reality here. I might see a news clip of Palestinians destroying a synagogue. It looks so hateful. And then I learn that during a land swap, Israel agreed to give back land upon which they had built a luxurious modern settlement. And before retreating, they destroyed every building in the settlement except the synagogue. When hardscrabble Palestinians, so poor and needy, walked into their land, they saw only rubble except for one building, a synagogue, and they got mad and destroyed that too. It's ugly both ways, but television coverage without context can leave the viewer with the wrong impression. Many Palestinians I met resent the terrorism tag that's typically applied to their community. One Palestinian told me, "Perhaps terrorists are terrorists only because they lack uniforms, tanks, and warplanes." Ramallah, Palestine's de facto capital. Ramallah is the boomtown of the West Bank. As bit by bit, under the settlement policy of Israel, the likelihood of East Jerusalem being the capital of Palestine is fading, Ramallah is emerging as a natural stand-in, hosting the Palestinian government and international agencies. The PLO headquarters is here. Yasser Arafat is buried here, and it's busy with NGOs and international agencies working on Palestine's problems. As many Palestinian Americans have moved back home and choose to live here, there are lots of American accents. The city of 340,000 people sits at about 3,000 feet above sea level. Its name, Ramallah, means God's mountain. As it lacks the trouble-causing religious sites and is more liberal and cosmopolitan than other Palestinian cities, I found it the most relaxed city in the country. With its international professionals and university students, Ramallah has an almost cosmopolitan energy. Whether coming together at the central square of the Lions or browsing down a stylish shopping street, the people of Ramallah inspire me to envision a peaceful and prosperous Palestine of the future. The number one site in Ramallah is the tomb of Yasser Arafat. While he certainly has plenty of detractors, this Palestinian statesman who led the PLO from 1969 to 2004 is, without a doubt, the father of modern Palestine. Call him what you like, people here celebrate Arafat as the man who did more than anyone else to raise awareness of the Palestinian struggle for independence. I found that while many Palestinians believe Arafat squandered some opportunities for peace they'd love to have now, nearly all respect him as an important leader who committed his life to forging a free Palestinian state. Growing up, the only Palestinian I was aware of was Yasser Arafat, Today, Arafat's tomb stands next to the Palestinian president's headquarters. A thoughtful museum at the tomb of the Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish introduced me to the author and poet who wrote the Palestinian Declaration of Independence. Darwish, who died in 2008, worked with Arafat but used a pen rather than a gun as his weapon. A reminder of the wide range of approaches the Palestinians have used to make their message heard. To get a more well-rounded feeling for modern Palestine, both in its people and its institutions, I popped into Birzeit University. Its campus at the edge of Ramallah has an enrollment of about 10,000. With beautiful landscaping connecting modern buildings and a student body that represented the future leaders of this young country, the campus was a sharp contrast with the intense and chaotic cities. A stroll through the campus gave me a chance to connect with young students and learn a bit about both their culture and their aspirations. It was inspiring. The hijab, the meaning of a scarf. At Ramallah's Birzeit University, I enjoyed a fascinating conversation with three smart young female Palestinian university students about the role of women in a Muslim society. Along with many other things, I was curious about the hijab, or the traditional head covering. Throughout the country, I noticed that some women wear it, while others don't. Like many Westerners, I'm intrigued and perplexed by the tradition of women in religious families or communities needing to be covered in public for modesty. Modesty requirements are not unique to Muslims. Some conservative Christian women are expected to cover their heads in church. Some ultra-Orthodox Jewish women are expected to actually shave their heads and to wear a wig in public. And many Muslim women cover their heads too. In Palestine, far more women wear scarves in conservative cities like Hebron and Nablus than in the more cosmopolitan cities of Bethlehem and Ramallah. For a Muslim man, it's a sin to look lustfully at a woman who's not his wife. Around here, hair is sexy, and in the strictest of Muslim societies, women carefully cover up every strand in public. Of course, in the privacy of their own domestic world, they're welcome to be as sexy as they like for their husbands. But the scarf, while meant to downplay a woman's beauty, has morphed into something stylish and sexy in itself. Women can be technically proper with their faith while still looking good. These days, scarves are worn like peacock tails. For many women, much care is put into coordinating their scarves, nail polish, handbags, and lipstick. One woman I met told me that she has over 100 scarves, and each morning she enjoys choosing one that fits her mood. It's an ensemble. You never wear a pattern on pattern or solid on solid. If the dress is solid, the hijab will be patterned. I picked up another fashion tip. Propping up the back end with an empty yogurt cup as you tie it gives your scarf a fetching lift. The women I talked with agreed that women are free to be individuals in Palestine and that choosing to wear a hijab was entirely up to them. The woman who covers up is just as socially active and in on all the jokes and fun. But when she walks down the street in public with her hair covered, she feels she gets more respect. As for the broader role of women in Palestinian society, the women at the university that I talked to pointed out that there were more women than men in higher education, and they felt that they could do anything they wanted to if they work hard. Still, they embraced the traditional roles, and the consensus was that a woman's role is generally to raise children and run the family, while the man's role is to be out making the money. Israelis and Palestinians. Who's right, who's wrong, who knows? My Holy Land trip had the best possible outcome. It challenged my preconceptions. I learned that people whose language always sounded to me like terrorists conspiring are actually gentle souls with big challenges. And it taught me that there are two sure things. Violence doesn't work, and neither the Israelis nor the Palestinians are gonna move. The only workable road in the Holy Land is one of peaceful coexistence. It's clear to me that if you care about the future of Israel, you must find a viable solution for Palestine. Creating security, dignity, and independence for Palestine is actually in Israel's best interest. Part of the long-term sustainable solution to this region's troubles. I know the hurdles are high, but hearing both narratives, I can envision a peaceful and prosperous Holy Land with both a secure Israel and a free Palestine. One thing is clear. good travel is all about connecting with people and better understanding their perspective. I learned what Muslims think of Jesus while sitting on a carpet with an imam. Talked about raising kids while sipping coffee with Israelis who live in a settlement overlooking the West Bank. And visited with a Palestinian refugee as he clutched the key his parents took with them when they fled their village in 1948. I talked with soldiers in guard towers, roasted coffee with a Bedouin, and gained insight into why a proud and independent young woman would choose to wear a hijab. And I chatted with a Hebron butcher next to the swinging head of a camel he just slaughtered for insight into his world. I remember when I first went on a political trip. It was back in the 1980s to Nicaragua and El Salvador. Seeing me off, my dad, suspicious of communism, said, "Don't be duped." Now, after a few weeks in the Holy Land, the latest chapter in more than 30 years of satisfying my curiosity about our world and its challenges by traveling and talking to people, I believe that the people most in danger of being duped are actually those who stay home. Traveling through the Holy Land, my heart was a shuttlecock flipping back and forth between sympathy for Israel and solidarity with Palestine. I'm saddened by the many people in Israel, Palestine, or the USA who are so hardened on one side or the other that they can't allow themselves to find empathy with the society they consider the enemy. Even if one side is the enemy, it's not the entire society. It's its leaders or its extremists. Just like American children of Catholic parents tend to be Catholic and children of Lutheran parents tend to be Lutheran, children of the Holy Land have their parents' baggage from the start. And when it comes to baggage, very few are packing light in Israel or Palestine. I'm concerned that as a result of the social and physical barriers that separate them, people on both sides will not get to know each other. These days, it's next to impossible for Israelis and Palestinians to connect in any way. Consider this. Israelis and Palestinians, who happen to be soccer fans, curiously root for the same Madrid team. But many don't realize that they have this fandom in common. There's just no way mutual fans of Real Madrid could be mutual enemies. Young Palestinians and Israelis are completely reliant upon hometown media, parents, and schooling to shape their opinion of the younger generation of the people on the other side of the wall, a generation they're destined to share their historic homeland with. There's a little turnout on the Palestinian side of the wall where passengers can conveniently change from a Palestinian car to an Israeli one. As I was leaving Palestine, my Israeli driver was there, waiting for my Palestinian driver to drop me off. While I barely knew either of these men, I'll never forget their handshake, in the shadow of an ominous Israeli watchtower, blackened by the flames of burning tires and tagged with angry Palestinian graffiti. These men were each beautiful, caring people, trapped in a problem much bigger than either of them. In the exchange, I was little more than a suitcase, shuttling from one back seat to the other. I watched as they quietly shook hands, looked into each other's eyes, and said a solemn and heartfelt shalom. And I thought, with all these good people on both sides, there's got to be a solution. And a big part of it will be regular people making not walls, but bridges. Chapter 10, Homecoming. After our whirlwind tour, it's time to wrap up our journey. No matter where you go, the final stop is always the same, and home is the best destination of all. Thankfully, our travels can inspire and empower us to make home even better. Reverse culture shock. Having traveled makes being home feel homier than ever. Part of my re-entry ritual is a good old-fashioned American-style breakfast at a local diner. I know just how I like it. Eggs fried over medium, hash browns, burn 'em on both sides, and toast, sourdough, done crispy, with Marionberry jam. As the waitress tops up my coffee and I snap my sugar packet before ripping it open, I think of how across this planet there are thousands of entirely different breakfasts eaten by people just as exacting as I am. And of all those breakfasts, it's clear that this one is the right one for me. I am home. Considering all the fun I have traveling, Feeling thankful to be home affirms my sense that I'm rooted in the right place. I enjoy the same Olympic Mountains view from my kitchen window that I did as a kid. I look out my office window, and I still see my junior high school. While I relish the culture shock of being in an exotic, faraway place, I also enjoy the reverse culture shock of returning to the perfect normalcy of home. As if easing from my traveling lifestyle back into my home lifestyle, I still function out of my toiletries kit for a couple of days before completely unpacking. The simplicity of living out of a single bag slowly succumbs to the complexity of living out of a walk-in closet in a big house with light switches and an entertainment system I've yet to master. Over time, I willingly fall back into the snappy tempo and daily routine of a busy home life. I do this because I'm not fundamentally a vagabond. I love my children, have fun running a business, enjoy the fellowship of the social hour after church each Sunday, and savor my daily stroll across town for coffee. If I had a top hat, I'd tip it to the ladies I pass along the way. And yet, after every trip, things remain a bit out of whack, but only to me. There's a loneliness in having a mind spinning with images, lessons, and memories that can never adequately be shared. Experiences such as finding out why the Salvadoran priest ignores his excommunication, why the Dutch celebrate tolerance, and why the dervish whirls. Travel changes you. Travel doesn't end when you step off the plane into your familiar home airport. The preceding chapters, while ranging far and wide across the globe, all illustrate how travel is rich with learning opportunities and how the ultimate souvenir is a broader outlook. I enjoy splicing what I've learned into who I am and what I do. By incorporating those lessons into my being, I am changed. Any traveler can relate to this. On returning home from a major trip, you sense that your friends and coworkers have stayed the same, but you're different. It's enlightening and unsettling at the same time. A wonderful byproduct of leaving America is gaining a renewed appreciation for our country. When frustrated by overwrought bureaucracies overseas, I'm thankful that it's not a daily part of my life back home. When exasperated by population density, I return home grateful to live in a sparsely populated corner of the world. Traveling, I sample different tempos, schedules, seasonings, business environments, and political systems. Some I like better. Others, I'm glad don't follow me home. When I return home from any trip, I realize that I'm part of the terroir of my home turf, just as the people who so charm me in distant corners of the world are part of theirs. Those people might visit me here, find it interesting, incorporate a few slices of my lifestyle into theirs, and be just as thankful to fly back home. While seeing travel as a political act enables us to challenge our society to do better, it also shows us how much we have to be grateful for, to take responsibility for, and to protect. For a high-contrast look at your own country, leave it. When we travel, we can enjoy a fresh and often clearer perspective on challenges facing our nation. We can see how other nations are dealing with the same issues. We can see the consequences of ignoring a budding problem that has ballooned into a big one. And we can see the beauty that results when a challenge is dealt with thoughtfully and successfully. From a distant land, you can look back at your own country and see its beauties and its shortcomings in higher contrast. The problems and the triumphs pop. Consider the gap between rich and poor. Consider the blessing of good government and a peaceful transition of power. Consider the benefits of a meritocracy as opposed to a more corrupt society. Appreciate a relatively small and efficient bureaucracy. Consider the impact of violent weather resulting from climate change. Consider the absence of anxiety about medical bills in a country with universal health care. Consider the results of legislating morality. And you can consider the beauty of involving seniors in everyday life rather than siloing them away. When you travel thoughtfully, you understand your own country better. It becomes more clear what's working well and what's not. And you can see where you can best contribute. Settling back into my hometown life, I embrace the idea that life is good. The world is not a scary place, and considering everything, these are good times. While I may seem to many like an activist, I've also learned that activism can be good stewardship of the status quo. I find that after a good trip, I'm quicker to celebrate and support what undergirds the stability and goodness in my community. Travel helps us to better see both sides of our privileged reality. In addition to gaining a keen appreciation of how blessed we are, travelers also understand that with these blessings come responsibilities. Protecting the poor, civil rights, and our environment are basic to good global citizenship. Travelers experience lands that have a wide gap between rich and poor, places without basic freedoms an American might take for granted, and regions where neglect has led to ruined environments. Packing that experience home, we can become more compassionate, even, or especially, during difficult times. Because we've seen the extremes in faraway lands, we can better understand the consequences of continued neglect in our own community. After a thought-provoking trip, I consume news differently. Since I've wandered through war debris with Alan and Mostar, news footage of any city being devastated by bombs suddenly aches with humanity. My memories of friends stiff with shrapnel and former parks filled with tombstones push me toward pacifism. During times of saber-rattling, I fly a peace flag from my office building. A neighbor once asked if I knew how much business I've lost by flying that flag. Because of what I've learned about the human costs of war in places such as Bosnia-Herzegovina, El Salvador, and Iran, it hadn't occurred to me to measure the economic costs to my business for speaking out for peace. In fact, it's hard for me to understand how anyone could support a war they didn't believe in because it was good for their business. Mark Twain wrote, "Travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness." These wise words can be a rallying cry for all travelers once comfortably back home. When courageous leaders in our community combat small-mindedness and ignorance, whether it's pastors contending with homophobia in their congregations, employers striving to make a workplace colorblind, or teachers standing up for intellectual and creative freedoms, travelers can stand with them in solidarity. I strive, not always successfully, to be tolerant. As a comfortable, white, Protestant, suburban American, a warm welcome always awaits me over at the tyranny of the majority. I recognize that intolerance can be a natural state of rest. I'm inspired by lands that have morals but don't moralize, lands that make tolerance a guiding virtue and consider peaceful coexistence a victory. I want to celebrate the diversity in American life by making room for people representing the entire range of human experience. And I want to help shape an America that embraces that openness on a global scale as it works to be a constructive member of the family of nations. Putting your global perspective into action at home. Traveling to learn, you find new passions. Had I not seen shanty towns break out like rashes in Cairo, I might not have gotten tuned in to affordable housing issues in my own community. After observing the pragmatic Dutch and Swiss approach to drug abuse, I chose to speak out on drug law reform and co-sponsor Washington State's initiative to legalize the recreational adult use of marijuana. Having traveled in the Islamic Republic of Iran, where religion and government are thoroughly interwoven, I've seen the troubling consequences of mixing mosque and state, or church and state. In my church, some want the American flag right up there in front, while others in my community would like to hang the Ten Commandments in our city hall. Because I care both for my church and my state, I work to keep my church free of flags and my city hall free of religious commandments. Travel becomes a political act only if you act. If you do something positive with your broadened perspective once you return home. The challenges on the horizon can be so overwhelming that they freeze caring people into inaction. While trying to save the planet single-handedly can be disheartening, taking a few concrete and realistic baby steps in that direction can be empowering and bring fine rewards. Because of my work, I've had some exciting opportunities in this regard. Below are a few personal examples of how I've incorporated passions sparked by my travels into real action back home. While we may have different wattage in our light bulbs because of our work and the niche we occupy in our communities, we all bring light to our communities. Teachers teach, preachers preach, shoppers shop, parents parent. Leaders lead, those with money fund, and voters vote. I'm sharing these examples of making a difference in hopes of demonstrating a few creative ways that you may do the same, on a larger or smaller scale. Be an advocate for those outside of the United States who have no voice here but who are affected by our policies. See our government policy through a lens of how will this impact the poor? Travel forces voters to consider a new twist on representative democracy. Whom should your vote represent? Because I've made friends throughout the developing world, my vote's based on more than simply, am I better off today than I was 4 years ago? Travelers recognize that the results of an election here in the United States can have a greater impact on poor people half a world away than it does on middle-class American voters. My travels have taught me that even if motivated only by greed, you don't want to be really rich in a desperately poor world. With this in mind, I think of it not as noble or heroic, but simply pragmatic to bring a compassion for the needy along with me into the voting booth. Share lessons, expect more from your friends, and don't be afraid to ruin dinners by bringing up uncomfortable realities. In a land where the afflicted and the comfortable are kept in different corners, people who connect those two worlds are doing everyone a service. To paraphrase Finley Peter Dunn, strive to afflict the comfortable in order to comfort the afflicted. By saying things that upset people so that they can declare they'd fight and die for my right to be so stupid, I feel I'm contributing to the fabric of our democracy. Take a stand. Taking a principled stand on any issue can be inspirational, both personally and socially. What do you care about? Civil liberties? Tasty food eaten in season? The downside of prisons for profit? States' rights? The danger to society of a single-chain bookstore driving independent bookstores out of business? Public funding of the arts? Pedestrian zones in city centers? The corrosive effect on democracy of money in politics? The beauty of professors being free to say whatever they like? The way Airbnb threatens the character of a community? Public access to waterfront? There are countless causes that your thoughtful travels can cause you to realize you care about. Get involved. After observing alarming trends in other countries, it's easier to extrapolate and appreciate where small developments in our own society may ultimately lead. Whether it's the impact of a widening gap between rich and poor, a violation of the separation of church and state, the acceptance of a tyranny of the majority, or the loss of personal freedoms in the interest of national security. Then, for the good of your community, you understand the importance of becoming active and speaking out against those trends. Encourage others to travel. For example, support student exchange programs. Many people have the resources to travel but live within a social circle where travel means Las Vegas and Walt Disney World. High schools and universities are putting more priority than ever on foreign study programs. For many, the funding is a challenge. One trip can forever broaden the perspective of a young person with a big future. Hosting a foreign student, while much easier to afford, can actually help create the same amount of international understanding as funding an American student's trip abroad. Every community has nonprofit organizations whose mission is to foster understanding between cultures, bringing the same benefits of travel to people at home who may not be able to travel themselves. These organizations do this by facilitating inbound travel and opportunities for people from distant lands to interact with American communities. For example, the World Affairs Council hosts students, businesses, and cultural exchanges, bringing the world into the USA. Your local chapter of the United Nations provides a great way to travel vicariously and would love to have you on their team. The Rotary Club recognizes the value of future community leaders being open to the world. Knowing which of these organizations are active in your community, you can support them and celebrate their work. You have choices. Do a survey of causes that interest you. Choose a couple that resonate, and then tackle these as a hobby. Working on my favorites, debt relief for the developing world, drug policy reform, and affordable housing brings me great joy. I have an excuse to focus my studies. I meet inspirational people, and I enjoy the gratification that comes with actually making a difference. Organizations like Jubilee USA Network need grassroots help in reaching their goal of bringing relief to the world's most heavily indebted nations. Bread for the World is a Christian citizens organization that effectively lobbies our government in the interest of poor and hungry people, both in our country and overseas.